The Volume.
What's up, this your boy Lil Duval, and check out my podcast, Conversations with Unc, on the Black Effect Podcast Network. Each and every Tuesday, Conversations with Unc podcast feature casuals and in-depth talk about ebbs and flows of life and the pursuit of happiness. Unlike my work on stage, I tap into a more serious and sensitive side to give life advice and simply offer words of encouragement, yet remind folks to never forget to laugh. Every Tuesday, listen to Conversations with Unc, hosted by Lil Duval on the Black Effect Podcast Network, iHeartRadio app, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Presented by AT&T. Connecting changes everything.
When you buy Kroger brand products, you feel like you're winning. That's because they offer proven quality at lower than low prices. In fact, we guarantee that you and your family will love how Kroger brand products taste, or you get your money back. So next time you're shopping for the family, look for delicious Kroger brand products, because they'll make you all feel like you're winning. Shop now, in-store, or online. Kroger, fresh for everyone.
Got menopause? We've got you. Hi, Jackie here, founder of ExoJackie. Feel supported throughout your menopause journey and beyond with our organic protein powders and symptom relief boosts. Formulated to keep bones and muscles strong, ExoJackie products help reduce bloating, hot flashes, and weight gain. Enjoy 20% off with promo code EXOPODCAST. Shop now at ExoJackie.com. Made for women by women.
This is John Middlecoff from 3 and Out with John Middlecoff. Superchargers, headlights, and more. With over 122 million parts, eBay Motors has everything you need to maintain your vehicle and level it up to peak performance. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, your part is guaranteed to fit your ride every time, or your money back. Stay on your A-game with all the parts you need at the prices you want. It's easy to bring home huge wins. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply.
Jenkins and Jones is brought to you by FanDuel. It's never been easier to play fantasy on FanDuel. Whether you love basketball, golf, soccer, or any other fantasy sport, there's a contest for every fan. FanDuel, more ways to win. Welcome to Jenkins and Jones on the Volume Podcast Network. It is Thursday, September 9th, and we have an episode that all three of us were very, very excited for. We're going to be joined by Hanif Abdurraqib, the author of They Can't Kill Us Until They Kill Us, which was our first book club selection. Really long, in-depth interview. Great talking to Hanif. But as always, Jenkins and Jones, hosted by my good buddies, Dragonfly Jones, a.k.a. Tyler.
Hey, everybody, how's it going?
LeJethro Jenkins, a.k.a. John.
What's up, bubbas?
And I'm Mike. And before we get to the interview with Hanif, I wanted to apologize. We talked about the Drake album. Our last episode was a music album. We talked about the Drake album for like a half hour, 40 minutes. I'm the person who is usually on Twitter while I'm working, and I kind of jot down topics for us to talk about. I was enjoying the holiday weekend. I was not on Twitter. And so I was not even aware that R. Kelly appeared or was credited in any way on this album. But we did get a couple messages from people saying, hey, you guys talked about this album for a long time without saying fuck R. Kelly. So I wanted to personally apologize for that, because I had like eight things to talk about on the album. And that literally was not on there. And I know that none of the three of us ever want to miss an opportunity to say fuck R. Kelly. So I'll go first, fuck R. Kelly. And then y'all go ahead.
I mean, people would hit me up saying that we didn't get it. We didn't talk about that. And, you know, we never, you know, sway from saying, like you said, fuck R. Kelly. You know what I mean? You know, they were saying that, you know, him deciding, which was a decision, you had a decision to keep that. You know what I'm saying? OG Ron C. Tidbit, or get him to, you know, do another one. You know what I'm saying? Or edit it out, whatever. You had a decision to do that or not, and you decided to keep it. You know what I'm saying? Understanding that you'd have to put, you know, R. Kelly as a co-lyricist, that is a political decision. That is not apolitical. You made a decision. You know what I'm saying? To me, it's the wrong decision. Fuck that nigga. You have the most streamed fucking album in Spotify history, and you choose to put money in R. Kelly's pockets. Fuck that shit. You know what I'm saying? What Noah said was some fucking bullshit, especially being that it, you know, it was such a minor thing. It was such a minor piece of the song and the album. And it was worth triggering those who have been hurt or affected, you know what I'm saying, by sexual assault, violence, whatever. You know what I'm saying? It fuck that excuse. There's no excuse for that. So, you know what I'm saying? Flat out, fuck R. Kelly and fuck them for doing that shit, bro. Like, that's disgusting. You know what I mean? You teamed up with that man no matter how much you decide or you, how you feel about it. You know what I'm saying? You teamed up with that man on that project, and that man is, his pockets are getting lined due to your actions, your decision, which is flat out fucked up.
Yeah. The shit that threw me, that blew me was the Noah apology, where he was like, you know, basically he said, make no mistake, we didn't want to do this, but we all agreed to it. So, I mean, how, what the fuck was that even about? You know what I mean? And Ron C is on OVO. Like, his fucking IG name is OVO Ron C. This is some shit y'all could have easily fixed, but y'all made a decision to stand by it. So, you know, fuck R. Kelly. I just want to get that in one last time, too.
Yeah, so we apologize for not talking about that shit. I dead ass missed the shit. I was on planes and driving and shit. But, yo, we wanted to make sure to add the addendum.
Yeah, we were tapped out. And I do apologize because I had not appropriately kind of checked up on that topic before we got into it. All right, stick around. We're gonna have our interview with Hanif, and then I think we're gonna talk for a minute afterwards. But I do want to just say up top, next week we're starting book two for the book club on the Thursday episode. So make sure you have How the Word Is Passed by Clint Smith, who is also a poet / prose writer, just like Hanif. We've accidentally discovered that's our aesthetic on the Jenkins and Jones show. But get that book and then read through the end of the Angola prison chapter. That's about the first third, and I'll kind of intro the book. We'll talk about those first chapters on next week's show. So How the Word Is Passed, read through the end of the Angola prison chapter, and enjoy Hanif. The NFL is back, and FanDuel Sportsbook is celebrating with 40-1 odds on any week one game. Who doesn't want to win $200 on a $5 bet? This is no Hail Mary. It's that simple. New customers get 40-1 odds when you place your first wager on any team to win. FanDuel is sports betting made simple. The app is so easy to use. Plus, when you win, you'll get paid in as little as 24 hours. To get you started, here's who I'm taking for my week one 40-1 bet. I'm one of those idiots who makes emotional bets. I like to root for my team, so I'm a big Niners fan. Betting on the Niners to beat the Lions in week one. I don't care if it's Jimmy G. I don't care if it's Trey Lance. We're going to beat the Lions. So I'm taking the Niners with those 40-1 odds. But offers like this are just one of the many reasons I love betting the NFL on FanDuel. It's the number one rated sportsbook app in America. It's easy to use, it's safe and secure, and there's fast payouts. See for yourself why FanDuel is America's number one sportsbook. They're always hooking you up with exclusive odds boosts, great promotions, and so much more. Just sign up with promo code JNJ, and you can win $200 on a $5 bet. That's promo code JNJ. That's J&J. Exclusively on the FanDuel Sportsbook app. Disclaimer, must be 21 and over and present in Arizona, Colorado, Indiana, New Jersey, Virginia, or West Virginia. New users only, $10 first deposit required. Must wager in designated offer market, max bonus $200. See full terms at sportsbook.fanduel.com. Restrictions apply. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER.
What's up? I'm John Wall.
And I'm CJ Toledano, and we're starting a new podcast presented by DraftKings called Point Game. We're now joined by 3-time NBA Sixth Man of the Year, elite bucket getter. Let's please welcome Jamal Crawford to Point Game, King of the Court one-on-one tournament. If they had it back in your prime, do you think you could have took it all?
I'm going to be honest with you. I don't think I could have took it all, but I think I would have shocked a lot of people. I think Kobe and everybody in their prime, Kobe would win a one-on-one contest.
Yeah, because you got to think, love he's going to guard. He don't care about guarding.
He's going to guard.
He's going to guard. Like, you see him in the Olympics, he's going to guard. And then on
I'm
top of
that. I'm like that, see that?
Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome Sam Cassell to Point Game.
I remember you came to my room crying tears. I mean, he was in a culture shock. And then he's going to withdraw us about winning.
Remember what I told you? I said, OG, you think I can get paid and go back and play in college because he didn't need it?
Check out Point Game with John Wall and CJ Toledano on the iHeartRadio app, DraftKings YouTube, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Now I'd like to introduce you to Meaningful Beauty, the famed skincare brand created by iconic supermodel Cindy Crawford. It's her secret to absolutely gorgeous skin. Meaningful Beauty makes powerful and effective skincare simple, and it's loved by millions of women. It's formulated for all ages and all skin tones and types, and it's designed to work as a complete skincare system, leaving your skin feeling soft, smooth, and nourished. I recommend starting with Cindy's full regimen, which contains all five of her best-selling products, including the amazing Youth Activating Melon Serum. This next generation serum has the power of melon leaf stem cell technology. It's melon leaf stem cells encapsulated for freshness and released onto the skin to support a visible reduction in the appearance of wrinkles. With thousands of glowing five-star reviews, why not give it a try? Subscribe today and you can get the amazing Meaningful Beauty System for just $49.95. That includes our introductory five-piece system, free gifts, free shipping, and a 60-day money-back guarantee. All of that available at MeaningfulBeauty.com.
Tired of restless nights? Meet Leesa, the sleep experts. Here at Leesa, we know that good sleep is essential for mental, physical, and emotional health. That's why their mattresses are made for exceptional comfort and support, catering to every sleep need. Check out Leesa's Sapira Hybrid Mattress, named Best Hybrid Mattress 5 years running. Sleep hot? The Chill Collection is built with cool-to-the-touch top fabric and layers of high-density comfort foams, all intended to remove excess body heat while maximizing comfort. With Leesa, getting a new mattress has never been easier. Delivery is free, and you have 100 nights to try out your mattress in the comfort of your home. Don't spend another night dreaming of better sleep. For a limited time, save up to $700 off select mattresses plus two free pillows. Go to leesa.com/iHeart for an additional $50 off mattresses and select goods. That's leesa.com/iHeart. Exclusions apply. See leesa.com for more details.
This is Jeff T from the Club 520 Podcast. You'll know when you get it. It'll say eBay, authenticity, guarantee. You'll feel it because when it comes to your feet, eBay has your back. Maybe it's that head-turning pair for hooping or a hot new collab. Whatever you're after, when you cop on eBay, you can trust that your kicks will be checked by experts, not just any expert, sneaker experts who live and breathe the culture. Real people with real hands-on authentication experience. That's when blue checkmark represents on our listing. eBay Authenticity Guarantee, meaning every inch, stitch, sole, logo is verified authentic through a detailed inspection. So when you finally step into those grill kicks, you'll realize the feeling is unlike any other. And with eBay Authenticity Guarantee, the feeling of real is always within reach. Ensure your next purchase is the real deal. Visit ebay.com for terms.
We're excited to bring on. We're more than excited. We're like nervously, geekishly, nerdily excited to bring on our special guest. We've been reading his book, They Can't Kill Us Until They Kill Us, as our first book club 2.0 book. Hanif Abdurraqib, thank you so much for coming on the show, man. We really appreciate it.
Yo, thanks for having me. It's a real pleasure. Yeah.
So we've got some questions, and then we've got a couple of reader questions as well, including, and from what I've learned from you reading this book, I think you'll be happy about this. We have some questions from some high school teachers, actually, some high school English teachers who think, yeah.
That's dope. Someone told me, I saw through some tweets or maybe something, did anyone ask a sneaker question? Someone's like, I'm going to ask a question about sneaker. I'm a big sneaker collector, and I never get to answer sneaker questions. And so I was like, finally, but maybe no one asked one.
They didn't send the email in, but Tyler, damn. Please make a note to ask Hanif. It's a good sneaker question. My first question right off the top, and I have to say as a writer, your book was so good. It made me like furious at points, bro. Like it's so insightful. And John and Tyler and I talked on the last two episodes as we were reading it about, it feels like a lot of conversations you have with your friends late at night where you feel like you're getting to some larger point about the world, but you actually put it down in an insightful, clearly articulated way. So thank you for writing it. We really enjoyed going through it. My first question for you, just from seeing the way that you see the world throughout the book, is do you consider yourself an optimist or a cynic in terms of the way you see the world and, you know, yourself and your life and your place in the world?
Well, that's a great question, because I think critically, it's not even a knock. I think the critical response is that I'm too cynical, in America at least, right? It's so funny. So They Can't Kill Us So They Kill Us right now is having like a weird revival in Italy. Like it was published in Italy in maybe July. And it's for some reason, it's like huge in Italy. And the Italian GQ reviewed it and wrote this thing that was like, what I absolutely love about this book is that it has no cynicism at all. But in America, you know what I mean? In America, they're like, this motherfucker is cynical. I don't consider myself an optimist. I don't think that optimism for me has much utility. And oftentimes I think I'm just not propelled by optimism. You know, like I'm not saying it's not useful, but I think that coming out of the Obama, like capital H hope era, people began to think that hope itself could propel us towards something useful because it's attractive or comfortable. And I just am not very propelled by hope. And I don't just mean politically. I mean, I'm also, you know, most of the sports teams I root for are terrible. You know, I'm a Timberwolves fan, right? Like lifelong Timberwolves fan. And so, and right now, you know, like right now everyone is like, oh, you know, I see this shit. I don't know if I can curse on here. I'm gonna curse on a little bit.
Yeah, you can curse as much as you want to the ends of earth on this show, yes.
Because I'm seeing that shit that's like, you know, I see Timberwolves fans like, man, we're gonna get Ben Simmons and our core is gonna be D'Angelo Russell, Cat, and Ben Simmons. It's like, yeah, if you get Ben Simmons, you're gonna have all four of those guys. You know what I mean? Like, I allow myself to believe first in the potential for immense disappointment. Therefore, in the moments where that is less likely, or the moments where that like doesn't come to fruition, I get to revel in that like comfortably, you know what I mean? I'm not saying I'm without joy. You know, I went to a sunflower farm this weekend and it was great. It was a lot of fun. You know what I'm saying? Like I seek out pleasure. But in the larger scope of political, social, sports fandom, all of that, I think that I first open myself up to the potential for disappointment. And that propels me to the work, organizing work or community work or the work of not paying attention to the basketball season when it becomes too overwhelming.
this book was so good that at moments I would like, I remember like reading the Prince essay and like giving it to my lady, like, you have to fucking read this right now. You know what I mean? And as soon as I finished reading it, she started reading the book herself. And yesterday she asked me a question. She says, what lens does he come from? And I thought in my first, I don't fucking know. You know what I mean? Like, you write cliche free. And I'm wondering, like, you know, where does your lens come from? Like, what inspires you to come up with these thoughts? Like, where did, what do you think about that?
That's such a good question. And I appreciate you passing that. You know, the wild thing about that essay is that it was written so hastily. A few of the things in the book, I think maybe like 7 to 10 essays were from my era writing at MTV News with that great cast of writers that were cast off by MTV News, like Dorian St. Felix, Ira Madison, Holly, you know, like Holly Anderson, Molly Lambert, so on. So Carvel Wallace, the great Carvel Wallace. And that Prince essay was written so hastily. You know, it was like, Prince is dead, we need something. I wrote that in maybe like a 45 minute stretch because I knew at the time, I was like, it's impossible to write about Prince's whole career. You know what I mean? And it's impossible to do an obituary that summons like the fullness of Prince's whole life.
John is furious at you right now. He's trying to hold back. He wants to cuss you out so bad for saying you wrote that in 45 minutes.
I texted Tyler and Mike and was like, he wrote about Prince in 4 pages what people could not do in a full book. You know what I mean? You gave Prince justice in 4 pages and that blew my shit. And you did it in 45 minutes. And I feel like you just shitted on me. But that's all good. Continue what you were saying.
But the thing is, in some ways, though, so I wrote it. I put the words on the page in 45 minutes. But I've been writing that since I saw that performance, right? Like, if you love an artist and you have a life that is tied to an artist in any way, you live your life mourning a world where that artist no longer exists. So yeah, like I put the words on that page on the page of 45 minutes, but from the moment I saw that Super Bowl performance, I was imagining a world where we wouldn't have Prince and all we would have was that performance kind of bronze and amber. And so I was writing that piece from the point that I saw that performance mm-hmm. on. But to answer the other question, I mean, I think, you know, like the lens that I most commonly relate to is the lens that no curiosity I hold is unworthy of exploration. Mm-hmm. Now, that doesn't mean that everything I think is worth writing and giving to the public, but it means that in the journey of trying to figure out some shit that I can't get off my mind, I might stumble on something, mm-hmm. you know, like so much of my brain is occupied by these weird, somewhat ridiculous rabbit holes, musical rabbit holes that I can't shake. Recently, I was just really immersed in this idea of the Virginia sound. I think I was sent down it. It was whenever Aaliyah's albums came out on Spotify, mm-hmm. or at least whenever One in a Million came out on Spotify. And I found myself once again thinking about Timbaland's production techniques and how that intersected with the Neptunes. And then I spent so much time thinking about the Virginia sound and what's defined, particularly that Virginia Beach area, you know? And that's, I could write something about that that's not useful for the public to mm-hmm. see, but through the research or through the excitements that sent me back to these musical archives or these historical archives, I might find something else that's mm-hmm. worthwhile. And so my lens is generally, I'm not a very confident person generally, right? But my lens is confident because I'm pretty confident that if I'm spending more than a day thinking about something, then it is knocking on the door of something else, which is knocking on the door of something else that is maybe worthwhile. And I can probably tie all those things together if I try hard enough.
You can tell by how you write your curiosity too. Like, I think like that defines, like, nobody that I know is brilliant is lacks curiosity. Your level of curiosity seems crazy. Like, how did you find yourself, you know, being, like you said, growing up poor, predominantly black neighborhood in the grunge scene? Like, that was interesting to me.
Well, yeah. I mean, I talk about this a bit in my new book. I'm always surprised, and I'm not trying to like shit on anybody else. I'm always surprised when black folks are like, you know, you get black folks who are like, well, I was listening to Nirvana and black people made fun of me for it or whatever the fuck, you know?
Yeah.
That just wasn't, I mean, I grew up in a primarily black neighborhood and all this, but I also grew up in like the golden era of college radio. And I grew up in a college town and I grew up with older siblings who were in college. And so that meant, you know, like, I don't know if y'all grew up in college towns when college radio was big, but that meant that like, you would get a Fuji song next to a Soundgarden mm-hmm. song, next to a Blind Melon song, next to a Helter Skelter mm-hmm. song. There, because it was all, college radio was great. It was all about the taste of whoever was in the chair. You know what I mean? And, you know, I found out about like suicidal tendencies and punk and hardcore through not only college radio, but the stuff my siblings were bringing back into the house. And this was in an era too, where like UMTV Raps would come on right before Headbangers Ball. And you could just, if you were up late enough and had cable, which my family did sometimes, you could just watch all the way through, you know? And there was no real delineation in that stuff for me. It was all like musical exploration. And all the punks that I knew coming up who like hip me to stuff were black kids mostly. And it also helped that I grew up around curious music listeners. Now, yeah, there were like the strict hardcore kids or the strict hip hop heads who didn't want to hear that other shit. But there were a lot of folks who were like listening to Lost Boys, but also listening to Minor Threat, you know, and would put that stuff on like side A. It was a big like tape dubbing era. So be like side A would be like AT Aliens and side B would be the new Weezer record, you know, that kind of stuff. And so when I came up, it bears mentioning too, that the easiest shows for me to access when I was like in my late teens were punk shows, because a lot of rap shows, you know, there were hip hop shows coming to the Midwest, particularly Cincinnati. I mean, Cincinnati is a very underrated, has a really underrated rap history. You know, High Tech was there, J. Rawls was there, just a real underrated rap. I mean, Reflection Eternal recorded there. But there weren't a lot of rap shows in the Midwest, or there were not nearly as many rap shows as punk shows. And punk shows, you know, you hit Detroit, Pittsburgh, Columbus, Dayton, Chicago. And if you had like $3 and like a canned good, you could see 10 bands. And there was a point in my life where it was very much like, well, I just want to see as much music as possible. And so, yeah, I went to hip hop shows too, but They were a little bit pricier to get into. And I was like, you know, in my early teens, I was like poor, like for real poor. And they were harder for me to get into. Some of them were like, you know, 18 up, 21 up. In punk shows, they hit a point where they just didn't care. It was like they would know your ID was fake and be like, you know, we don't even care anymore, you know. But hip hop shows, you had to do with the flashlight looking at the ID type shit. And so it was, at some point, it was easier for me to get into more punk shows more often. And that was the scene I was on, you know. And I think punk and hardcore shows made me feel a different range of emotions than hip hop shows made me feel. Cause at that point, like the hip hop shows I was going to that I was like putting down money on were like dream shows. Like I remember seeing Wu-Tang Clan playing Columbus in like a small packed room, you know, we're talking like, you know, post Wu-Tang forever, but when the group was still together, you know, that type shit where, you know, and seeing that was like life changing. And so the hip hop shows I was going to were these big, massive, life-changing ones. And the punk shows were like, well, I'll see any band on any bill anywhere. You know what I mean? Like that kind of thing.
Yeah. So Hanif, I think we're about like the same age. It was there like a particular song that was kind of your gateway into like the rock scene? Because like if you're like our age, it was fucking Teen Spirit. You know what I mean? Yeah. Like that was every black kid's gateway into rock. You know what I'm saying? So is there a particular song that sticks out to you that kind of opened your eyes? Like, yo.
Teen Spirit, sure. But I think actually if I were to pick a Nirvana song, it would be In Bloom.
Mm-hmm.
Like I remember In Bloom. I heard Teen Spirit first, undoubtedly, because the video was everywhere. Yeah. And for a long time, I feel like I consume music largely through music videos. And there were I remember the music video for Teen Spirit was everywhere to the point where it was like, I feel like I talked to a homie about this recently and she remembered it too. I was like, yo, did BET play that shit? Like,
I feel like it was on Yo MTV Raps one night, bro.
It was on Yo MTV Raps, right? It was everywhere.
It was everywhere. Yeah.
But In Bloom was a song I remember the most. I was always a big chorus kid, you know? And I loved melody. From an early age, I loved melody. And there was something about In Bloom that was so melodic and infectious that even as like a 7-8 year old or whatever, I really latched onto that. And then I realized that was happening in other bands like Mudhoney and Soundgarden. And that unlocked some stuff for me, really. And like my older brother would listen to Metallica. My brother was listening to metal, you know, and like that would unlock some stuff for me. My sister was very into women singer-songwriters like Liz Phair, Alanis Morissette, that type of stuff.
That whole Lil' Phair crew, you know, back then.
Yeah. And so that, I mean, all that stuff was happening concurrently. And I was like, yo, this is like, and this was while hip-hop was always kind of, like hip-hop was the given in my household, right? And in my neighborhood, you know, that was what was coming out of the cars. I always used to joke about, you know, the stuff that the people I knew listened to riding down the block, the stuff they would turn up when they hit the neighborhood was maybe a little different than the stuff they'd listen to on the highway or the stuff they would listen to, you know, I mean, like with the windows up elsewhere, you know, people listening to like Alanis Morissette, you ought to know when they're kind of cruising, but when they hit, you know, when they get off at the James Road exit, you know, they're rolling down the windows and they're turning up like I Got Five on It, you know, or whatever the like deep bass stuff out of Texas, like UGK or whatever. And that was like my experience too. And it's funny because like when I got my first car, that was also, as much as I used to be on some shit, like I'm gonna listen to what I listen to and people are gonna hear. I was still that dude, you know, when I got my first car, it was like late 90s. And I remember the big, big thing, although I think it's funny for people now. I remember when the Nelly versus happened and people were like, no one listened to Nelly. And I was like, oh, y'all weren't outside. Facts. You know what I mean? Like y'all just don't remember. Like, yeah, I think people just don't remember. Because the era of people listening to Nelly admittedly wasn't very long. It was long enough, but it wasn't like super long, but like people were listening. Like when I got my first car, I listened to Country Grammar and I listened to that St. Lunatics album all of the time, you know? But when I was like cruising on the highway, I was listening to like, you know, Neutral Milk Hotel, you know, that kind of stuff.
That's the first time we've had a neutral milk reference on Jenkins and Jones. I'm very confident of that. I just want to ask you about music generally, because I mentioned in the first show where we talked about the book that I feel like a lot of times I listen to music a lot, but I don't read a lot of music criticism, because I find a lot of times that the writing that's good enough to interest me is almost like the writers are afraid to write about Alanis Morissette and Nelly, because they're looking for stuff that hasn't, the ground that hasn't been turned over as often, right? And yeah. It's like you're writing about Fleetwood Mac and Prince and like much more well-known stuff, which I appreciated. I want to just ask you about music itself. What do you feel like sport, it's like eating, sports, music, there's like three or four constants of human civilization, right?
Yeah.
Where do you think it comes from that, like, you know, like we were drawing stuff on the walls and making beats on rocks or whatever 8,000 years ago? Like, what do you think that comes from? And you've seen so many different sides of the musical experience, at least in America. Like, what is that? Where do you think that comes from? And how does that kind of connect people in a way that, as you touch on in the book, basically nothing else, including our actual shared humanity, connects people?
Yeah. I can only speak for myself, and it's that I have an obsession with sound in the way that sound, you know, what's wild about the English language, and perhaps, I mean, certainly every language, but English is the only one I'm fluent in. So at least for now. Mm-hmm. But also I grew up learning Arabic, right? I was raised Muslim, and in some ways I learned Arabic alongside the learning of English. And this is perhaps a meaningless delineation, but I think when people talk about the voice as instrument, I often think actually like language is instrument, and the voice is just kind of the amplifier through which the instrument travels. And when I think about it like that, I think the most fascinating thing to me in Arabic is, and in English, is that it's a sound work. It's a sound tapestry. If I put certain words next to other words, then I am in fact building my own symphony, right? This is perhaps my poetic leanings coming out. You know, I write poetry, yeah, as well. And like the experimentation of writing poetry for me is understanding that language itself can build towards something symphonic if we are thoughtful about what words sit next to what other words. Words can be percussive, right? I think about this with rappers. I mean, LL Cool J, I'm not talking about like Headsprung LL Cool J. But LL Cool J in his prime was so ferocious, yeah, because he understood the relentlessness of percussion, like how language could be percussive,
right?
Mm-hmm. Right? And it felt like he was just hitting you over and over and over, right, and over. He's not the only rapper. I mean, Jadakiss, we just saw Jadakiss put on a clinic, like a clinic. And I know that like there are other things happening. There's breath control, there's flow, there's cage, but it was also like a clinic in language, you know, in modulation of like percussive language goes here, melodic language goes here. And when you think I'm done being melodic, I'm going to push that further so that the percussion shocks you more. Like the best rappers and delivers of language, not just rappers, and all of music, I think, deliver an understanding of not just language, but how language can be symphonic. And so I think music works because there's an obsession with sound and the many things that sound can do. My voice doesn't sound the way it sounds in my head. You know what I'm saying? Like the way I sound in my head is not the way I sound to you all right now. And I know this for a fact, right? I've reluctantly and begrudgingly heard myself on recordings that I have to hear myself on, as you all who make podcasts know you have to do sometimes. Right. And so I know for a fact that my voice is the way I sound. It sounds, you know, in a different way. But if you put me in a room that echoes and I say a word and I hear my voice echo off of multiple walls in different ways and return to me in all those different ways, I'm going to be fascinated by it anew. Even though I know in my head, like, this shit is not the way I think I'm sounding. That's like a high level answer to a very simple question, and I apologize. But I do think there's a fascination. I mean, babies are fascinated by sound. We come, you know what I mean? Like,
Yeah, you can go boop at a baby, yeah, and it's like watching The Godfather Part Two. You know what I mean? You could do that, yeah, for 4 hours. It's just like,
it's like,
what?
A baseline understanding that, like, that we access from an early age, the sense of wonder that comes with hearing sound.
So Hanif, man, building off what you just said, I don't know if you remember how we got acquainted on Twitter, but this was 2017, right? And I had tweeted, yeah, out, we need a 10-year appreciation post, oral history or something on Wipe Me, yep, Down, right? And then you hit me up like, I kind of wrote something like that. You know what I mean? And you wrote, and you hit me to this piece that you wrote, Wipe Me Down in the Ballad of Baton Rouge, where you kind of drew, you kind of talked about how Wipe Me Down and how Baton Rouge's moment kind of all tied into, like, you know, the resiliency of post-Katrina Louisiana people, you know, the emergence of Baton Rouge from New Orleans shadow on the rap scene. And I was reading that like, yo, this motherfucker's mind is like, like, bro, I would have never drew those parallels. You know what I'm saying? And so going back to what you said, and I'm hoping you give another high level answer here. Like, how do you see the parallels that you draw when you draw, you know, things about music into, you know, your societal observations or your opinions and such?
I think it's because, you know, we learn through the flawed nature of America's school system, we learn things about history that aren't the full story, right? And through those understandings, I think some of us become more skeptical of history, or at least understand that that's not the full story always, right? And because I didn't learn about, you know, the song Wipe Me Down in school, because I didn't learn about Fleetwood Mac's Rumors in school or whatever the fuck, my starting point is there's a story here that is beyond this story. Like, Wipe Me Down didn't come out of nowhere. This moment that Baton Rouge had did not come out of nowhere. There's something there. I was thinking about this yesterday because I was thinking about Mac Miller, as I often am. And I was thinking about that brief moment in time where it felt like Pittsburgh was going to be,
yeah,
the new New York
Wiz,
for rap,
yeah,
music.
But, yeah.
Yeah, but that also didn't come out of, I mean, if you were there, you know, if you were around when Mac Miller was selling mix CDs out of his trunk of his car, and when Wiz was kind of like, you know, emerging slowly, and when Chevy Woods was, you know, like all of these things were happening very deliberately, and there was a history that led to them happening, and Baton Rouge was no different. And so I'm always asking the question of, how did this moment, how did the moment we see, what can we not see that made the moment we see exist? Like, that's always the question for me. And I didn't even think about Katrina and the history of Katrina until I talked to folks who are from Baton Rouge. For that piece, I talked to folks, you know, it wasn't a reported piece, but I know folks from New Orleans. I know folks from Baton Rouge, and I know folks whose people fled New Orleans and settled in Baton Rouge for a bit. And there's a history there that makes me remind myself this song didn't just come out of nowhere. This moment didn't just come out of nowhere. And I know, you know, personally, I would be fine if I never heard Boosie say anything again.
Yeah,
about like anything.
Yeah.
But I, you know, that's a tricky thing, right? The art that we create and the art that means something to us, it exists in a past that cannot and should not have to answer for the present or the future. And so I still love Wipe Me Down. Do I wish that Boosie was not currently relevant in any way? Of course. but that doesn't detract from what that song meant to me at the time, and what that song like meant to a real community of people too. Like, that means more than what a song meant to me always. When I'm examining a song or thinking about a song, I'm always thinking about like, what did this mean to a community of people who, I mean, if we're gonna talk about Wiz and Pittsburgh, like, I remember I was thinking last night about these regional songs that become national songs, right? You know, Black and Yellow was very deeply regional. Wale's Nike Boots, you know, was a deeply regional, like, DC anthem that, like, was also on the radio here. And that means that for a moment, I got a window into a world that I don't have access to otherwise. That's a miracle. Like, wipe me down in sound, in tone. A couple weeks ago, shout out Jinx, Brandon Jinx Jenkins. I did this thing with Jinx on Mogul. We talked about DJ Screw. Mm-hmm. And we talked a little Kiki. Shout out Lil Kiki, also a legend.
Southside, yes,
and
sir.
We talked about we talked about Screw. And the first time we heard Screw, you know, Jinx and I aren't from Texas, you know, like, and I talked to, you know, like, that was my understanding of Texas. That's how I understood Texas, you know, like, I understood swang and I understood this type of shit, this slang, and I understood what the cars looked like. I understood this type of thing because that music existed. And Wipe Me Down was kind of no different. And so I can't think about these songs without thinking about the communities they sprung forth from, in those communities, in the windows that were open to me as a person growing up in Columbus, Ohio, who wasn't at that point all that well traveled, who still got to have access to slang and to fashion and to worlds that I couldn't touch.
How do you approach making a book like this? I thought it might be like an album where you write a number of essays, some make it, some don't. The ones that are most cohesive, I guess. I wonder how do you approach this? Also, are there like essays that you were talking about earlier, some aren't meant to be seen by public, that you love,
yeah,
that didn't make the book as well?
There's one, and I know he's in the news again for unfortunate reasons that I don't fully understand and have chosen not to look into, but there was one really great one on 50 Cent that didn't make it, about kind of like because I think, I mean, we all joke about, like, you know, you wasn't outside, et cetera, et cetera. But to be the 50 Cent era, the Get Rich or Die Trying era, is so wild and like so hard, I think, for people to fathom now. There was a point where, much like DMX, I remember, there was a point where, like, I didn't know what DMX looked like. The hype around him was so large. Or I remember when he was DMX the Great, he had that like unsigned hype column in the Source, but like there was a hype around him that was so big, and I didn't see what he looked like until the Get At Me Dog video. You know, 50 Cent was kind of the same way. I remember the Power of the Dollar, that mixtape, but I didn't know what he looked like. I just remembered like Ghetto Quran and like these songs. And then Get Rich or Die Trying hit. So there was an essay that didn't make it on 50 Cent. But you know what's wild about They Can't Kill Us is, and I feel like this story has been, the story of the making of the book has been a bit glamorized now and a bit exaggerated, but the truth is I wrote it in about 3.5 weeks, the unpublished parts. We're in about 3.5 weeks in the winter of 2016. I was going through a really rough time that was later outlined in my poetry book, Fortune for a Disaster. I was going through a divorce, and I was going through like a really rough era. And I was living in Connecticut at the time, which I hated. I hated living in Connecticut. You know, I was like, I miss home. And I was preparing for the next phase of my life, which was undoubtedly going to take me out of Connecticut. And I knew I had to write this book. And it was winter. I left Connecticut around like before Thanksgiving to go to Provincetown, Massachusetts, on the very edge of the easternmost point of the states. And Provincetown, I went there because it's like a beach town, you know, it's like it's like a touristy beach area, but in the winter, no one's there. Like no one at all is there, except for maybe like, you know, a couple shops keeps who stay open and the bar keeps who serve the town drinkers who stay around. And it gets dark early. You know, the day I pulled up there and it was dark by like 4:30. And because it's a beach town, everything closes in the winter kind of when they want to. There's like one grocery store, and the grocery store was like closing kind of whenever it wanted. Where it was like, if it's noon and no one's coming through, we're closing. And so I got into this routine where I'd get up, I'd run on the beach before 11. I would go to the grocery store and get food for the day, and I would write. And at night I would watch movies, you know, or I'd watch basketball. I got in this habit of watching like.
That sounds incredible.
Writery. That's glamorized right here, as you know what I mean?
It's romantic. Yeah. It was to be super, it was like the most direct depressing point of my adult life, maybe, but it was cool looking back.
There we go.
Right.
I had this like, I was watching, I for some, somehow I had gotten like, DVDs or hard drives of like old NBA Finals series from like when I was growing up. And so I was watching, I remember watching the one game the Sixers took off the Lakers in that NBA Finals where it was just Iverson like in another universe. I mean, all through that playoff series, but I remember that one game they took off the Lakers. And I remember watching it over and over again and being like, because I remember watching that in real time and being like, I feel like everyone going into that series knew the Sixers had no shot. Mm-hmm. And we had just witnessed them. In some ways, it was reminiscent of the Hawks this year, where I think like watching the Hawks, the Trae Young Hawks kind of get through the playoffs in the way they did and then hit the Bucks. It was like, if they take one game off this team, that's a miracle, you know? And that's how I felt. And I just remember in Provincetown, at it pitch black at 5:30 p.m. watching Allen Iverson in that finals. I just had a lot of weird archive basketball stuff. It was very Iverson focused. I watched Iverson's Georgetown game against like the Ray Allen UConn Huskies, you know, and like there was something about this as a basketball fan. You know, I'm sure I grew up playing basketball and I'm short. I'm very short. I'm like 5'6". And I always wanted to be Allen Iverson. I always wanted to be Allen Iverson, but I was more like a Earl Boykins, you know. I can't really score, but I can facilitate. I won't turn the ball over. But, you know, I never wanted to be Michael Jordan. I always wanted to be Allen Iverson. And so I had all of this Iverson archival footage I was watching while working on this book for some reason. Like Georgetown Iverson, Sixers Iverson, underrated Nuggets Iverson, which is actually, I think, some of his best basketball. But, I had all this shit that I was just watching at night. And that is how the book was written.
How's the process? Like, I appreciate the process, but I don't enjoy writing. You know what I mean? Like, it's fulfilling, but it's not fun. Your work is like, you know, it's very beautiful, but you explore some, you know, pretty dark, you know, subjects. What does your process look like? What's that experience like?
Oh, I take to the work with a lot of excitement, you know? I'm a big Toni Morrison disciple in part, you know, we're both Ohioans and she is for me, the greatest Ohioan. It's like her, LeBron at two. And, you know, then there's probably a wide gap for getting to some of the other folks, but, and there are a great many other folks. I don't want people to hear this, start sending me other great Ohioans. Trust me. I know them.
Crazy. Bomb.
But you know, there was an excitement. Yeah. Yeah. You know what I mean? Like, I try to take to the work with an excitement and wonder. Some of that's through because I believe in research as a tool of like unlocking pleasure in things I didn't know before. There's so much stuff I don't know. In writing or researching gives me an opportunity to kind of tap into things I don't know. And when I'm tapping into things I don't know, I'm at my most excited as a writer. And I just want to run, you know, when I was working on my new book, when I was working on A Little Devil in America, the opening chapter is this piece about Soul Train and Don Cornelius. And I'd gotten this hard drive of every Soul Train episode from like the early 70s to the late 80s. And I just watched it all the time while working on this piece, this one piece. I watched hundreds, if not thousands of hours of Soul Train. And when I was done, I was like, this is the writing. The Soul Train episodes are the writing. The fact that I could see Jody Watley performing as a Soul Train dancer and then see her on the Soul Train stage. That is the essay. My job is to just be a vessel, to be an evangelist for what has already happened. And that is exciting work. That piece in They Can't Kill Us about Iverson's crossover, like I remember seeing that shit as a kid and not having the language to explain how excited it made me. And now that I have the language, what else am I to do but be like, y'all, this shit happened. Like you might not have been there, but this happened. Yeah. You know what I mean? And like, I know it happened because other people who I know saw it happen alongside me. And we don't know each other yet, but because we witnessed this at the same time, we all know each other, you know? And so there's a pleasure I take, you know? And even when I'm approaching subjects that are difficult, you know, the piece, the centerpiece of the book is maybe Fall Out Boy Forever. And that was a hard thing to write. And it's a hard thing to sit with now, but I got to bring someone I love back to life for a little bit. You know, as someone who's lost a lot of people in my life, it's a blessing to get to have access to language that reanimates the way I feel about someone and gets to bring them fully rendered into a world that I'm making. If I'm thinking about this as though I'm building a museum of my own making, every wing of that museum cannot hold only grief. You know what I'm saying? It's got to hold the pleasure that gets me both into and out of the grief. Grief is a tunnel, man. And like, if you fuck around with it and don't think about your entrances and exits as pleasureful or perhaps joyful or perhaps critical moments, then your tunnel of grief is going to be never ending. And you're just never going to be able to wind your way out of it. And yeah, sometimes it's longer for me than other times, but that shit, you got to really honor the fact that that's a tunnel. So it needs to have an entrance and an exit.
Real shit. I was going to say, I'm going back to, you know, what you said about your Iverson piece, because that's one of my favorite pieces in They Can't Kill Us. It rained in Columbus, Ohio, the night Iverson crossed over Michael Jordan. And there's certain writers that when you think of them, you know, you think of where they're from. And when I think of you, I think of Columbus, and because it plays such a huge part in their writing, you know, like Baldwin and Harlem are intrinsically linked, you know, same for like Nikki Giovanni in Tennessee. But, you know, whereas these writers are kind of like fleshing out places they're familiar with, like we're all familiar with NYC, even if we've never once been there before, because it's all over TVs and movies and such. So, you know, we're familiar with NYC, and, you know, Balding's writing, like, it fleshes it out for us. And, you know, I mentioned Nikki Giovanni. Her backdrop was, you know, often like the country back roads of Tennessee. And even if we've never been to her particular neck of the woods, we're all familiar with the country in some aspect, you know, because lots of us spent summers down there and all that. And, you know, Columbus plays such a huge part in your writing. And, you know, no shots to Columbus, but lots of us don't know shit about Columbus. You know what I mean? So, you know, it puts you in a unique situation where you're not in a well-known place where you're fleshing out something familiar for the reader, but you've been providing with a blank canvas, so to speak, where you're painting the whole picture of Columbus for us. So how does it feel to be in, you know, a unique circumstance like that, you know, coming from Columbus?
Yeah, I mean, I would guess a lot of us are like of a similar age, and so y'all can relate to this, but I grew up in kind of like this era of Black coming-of-age film, be it like Juice, Boys in the Hood, Menace to Society, South Central, so on and so forth. And that means that I witnessed Black youth through a very coastal lens, you know? But a lens that did not feel that different from my own. Like, there's the scene of the kids and boys in the hood in the beginning, and I remember being like, well, that's not that different from the type of shit me and my boys would get up to in our neighborhood in Columbus. And there are elements of this that aren't as different. And there are elements of Juice that, looking back, weren't that different. And I would watch Above the Rim and be like, this is like the Gus Macker. You know, like, this is a Gus Macker in Columbus. This tournament looks familiar. All this stuff. I was like, if there's all these familiarities in these narratives that are supposed to be explicitly coastal and specifically coastal, maybe my city is actually not that unworthy of having stories told about it. You know, like, maybe my city is also my first book of poems, A Crown Ain't Worth Much, was wholly inspired by Good Kid, Mad City. Good Kid, Mad City came out, and I listened to it, and I was like, conceptually, this is a piece about like coming of age in Compton, right? And I was like, I have a book in me, I have a book of poems that I know can mirror this coming of age story in an ever-changing city. You know, and that's what I did. And I think that so much of my work from that point on was like, how can I tell stories in a way that makes people feel like my city is their city, or my city, or they've seen a city like my city, close to their city, or they've set foot in a city like my city? How can I talk about a barbershop and have you think about your barbershop, even though it's my barbershop? You know what I mean? How can I talk about a fist fight happening in a schoolyard, even if it is my fists, how can I make them feel like your fists, or that you are witnessing a fight that you've witnessed before in a schoolyard close to you? These kind of things. I don't think that takes skill. I just think it takes trust. You know, I don't think I'm overly skilled at scene setting. I think I just refuse explanation. And through that refusal, I'm saying, I trust you to visualize where I'm at, because it's not all that different from where you're at. Yeah, I mean, like, there are some things exclusive to Columbus that don't exist anywhere else. And and this is because I'm a close reader and close watcher of culture. It's that thing I talked about before about how music, about how DJ Screw or like the G-Funk era or all this shit gave me access to these worlds that I didn't know. I could touch, I could feel them, I could sense them. You know, when The Chronic came out, motherfuckers was in Columbus putting Daytons on cars. You know, it was like weather be damned. You know what I mean? Like unpredictable weather be damned. We putting Daytons on these cars. You know, when people were, you know, when people were low riding Cadillacs and shit, when, you know, UGK had, you know, this type of stuff was happening. And my whole thing was, when you grow up in a city like that, that is a container for other city, the culture of other cities. You know, when early OOs, when Averex jackets was popping, motherfuckers here were wearing Averexes in summer. I was one of them. You know, that's one of those people who wearing Averexes in like 70 degree weather. You know?
He was wild.
And it's because.
Right. Leather is a motherfucker, like, man. It's like 20 pounds of leather, too. You know what I mean?
My dog thought he was Eddie Murphy in the 80s out here, bro. Leather down in the summer.
Shit. Wet as fuck under that damn jacket. But anyway.
It was wild. You know, it was like. When you grow up in a city like that, that's a container for the culture of other cities, you can lose sight of the fact that your city itself can also drive a conversation around how people think about place from where they're at. You know what I mean? And so I wanted to kind of, after spending for real a lot of time witnessing and taking part in the mimicry and mirroring of New York or Los Angeles or Texas or Atlanta, and some of this is by virtue of migration, you know, like Black folks, you know, we're, you know, Chicago is a city, but it's also like a Southern state. Mm-hmm. Detroit is like a Southern state, you know, in some ways Cleveland is like a Southern state. So some of this is filtering into that. But I did also want to present a world where it's like, well, Columbus, I grew up in this place and it's real, much like where you grew up was real. And I feel like I can articulate that in a way that, that allows you to feel something. Mm-hmm.
This is the last question for me. And then I've got, I highlighted some of the reader questions that we can throw in as well. Cool. After you've asked yours, you've mentioned that, you're a poet, you know, as well as being a critic and doing the kind of, prose writing that we, read in the book. How different is your approach when you're sitting down to write one versus the other? Can you not do those back to back? Is it a completely different mindset, or does it all feel like kind of one process to you?
I always wish I had a better answer for this, but I don't. It's the same, because I'm not really governed by genre. I'm kind of governed by curiosities and excitements, and I sit down to write oftentimes not knowing what I'm writing until it emerges. But there's a freedom in that too, because it's like it clarifies itself not only in the editing process but in the writing process too. You look at a piece and They Can't Kill Us, like Defiance Ohio's name of a band, that piece is almost genreless in form, you know, in structure. It's just one run. It's like one long run on sentence. And in order to be comfortable with that and not want to tweak it or not want to adjust it for aesthetics, I got to be able to say, okay, well, genre no longer means anything to me when I'm sitting down to write. I'm sitting down thinking about how this will sound to the ear, or how to look on the page, or how to draw people in. That kind of stuff governs me more than the idea of genre. Of course, I believe there is a difference between a poem and an essay. I'm not saying, you know, genre be damned. Otherwise, I've, you know, lied to folks. But, you know, I certainly have essay books and poetry books and all that, but I don't sit down thinking about writing one or the other.
John, Tyler, do you have any other questions before we get to the some of the ones the readers emailed in?
Yeah, I got one last one. So, I saw that you were commissioned by the Marvin Gaye Estate to do the preface on the 50th anniversary of What's Going On. So congrats on that, man. First off,
that was cool.
Yeah. So I'm wondering, because, you know, in They Can't Kill Us, every part is you know, prefaced by a Marvin Gaye piece on when he performed the national anthem that time. So is that what made the Gaye Estate reach out to you? Like, is that what caught their eye? Or
I think maybe I've written about Marvin Gaye a lot because I'm fascinated. I mean, my last poetry book, A Fortune for Your Disaster, is kind of tied together through a series of Marvin Gaye poems. Yeah. And I'm just very fascinated by Marvin Gaye's flaws and immense gifts. And you know, I actually don't think, you know, I was thankful to write that, and I do think I did an okay job, but, you know, the Marvin Gaye albums that fascinate me the most are Let's Get It On and Here, My Dear. I don't think those are the best. I mean, I do think What's Going On is probably the best album of his. But as we know, I mean, critically, there's a difference between like the best and the shit that compels us the most, you know? And so while I do think What's Going On is the best Marvin Gaye album, I'm so compelled by Here, My Dear and Let's Get It On, which is this, you know, Let's Get It On is this like really chaotic, frantic, lonely album. I think people think about it by its title track. So there's like, you know, putting the spotlight on like, this is now about sex. And like, yes, it's about sex, but it's also about like emptiness, you know? And it's so chaotic. I don't think people think about it as a chaotic album. That shit is chaotic as hell. And so, yeah, I think because I've written so much about Marvin Gaye, they were kind of interested in what I do with that. And that's honestly like one of the biggest honors of my life was to get to do that.
That's awesome, bro. My dog and some of that Robin Thicke settlement money, man. I'm happy for you, bro.
Yes, sir. Shout out to Robin Thicke, you know what I mean?
Shout out to Robin Thicke. Look how the universe works. Let's get into these reader questions, man.
All right, Hanif. Kevin asks, in the book you wrote, even now I'm not as invested in things getting better as I am in things getting honest. Kevin wants to know, do you still feel that way? And do you feel like things have gotten more or less honest since you wrote that essay?
Well, I think people have had to become more honest with themselves. The individual has had to become more honest with themselves, which means that industry, institution, capital, empire, et cetera, has had to combat that by becoming less honest with the people. Even less honest than it already was, right? I think that's the essay where I said some shit like, you know, like it was been a bad year and it's gonna get worse. And people hammered me so much for that. People are like, I love this essay, but why aren't you ending on a note of hope? And it's like, because I know better. Because I know better. And I think a lot of people in general, but like if I'm honing in specifically, I think a lot of Black folks know better. And what, you know, in 2017 was indeed worse, you know? And I don't think worse means more hopeless, because I do think that people I know and love have had to become more honest with themselves. And that's not an act of hopelessness. That's an act of great care. It takes great care to be honest with yourself. It's a delicate practice to be honest with yourself. And so I do think that is something that has happened. And I think Kevin's question is good. And I'm sorry that I'm not more hopeful, but I think the more honest individuals become, the less honest, or the everywhere else will find less of a commitment to honesty to combat that or to attempt to combat that.
If I can offer a brief commentary on what you pointed out is the difference in the American and Italian reactions to the book. People in America are embarrassed or angry at the reality that you describe. And so they feel that you are the cause of that in some regard, right? In Italy, if we're reading about, if we in America are reading about Italy's treatment of refugees from Africa, we are seeing that as their problem. And so we're not saying, oh, this person is cynical because he's accurately describing a shitty situation, right? So I felt, and I know you described yourself in this interview and in the book as not necessarily being an optimistic person. What I loved about the book was you're a realist, but who says things like getting to listen to music from where I'm from in Long Beach is that you describe that as a miracle. Right. You write about music beautifully. Like you see the world clearly, I guess. And sometimes because the world fucking sucks in many regards, maybe that comes across as more cynical. Right. But I like your use of the word honesty there, because I think that's a better, that's more accurate than just trying to frame it as, do you end things on happy or sad notes? Right. Like honesty is a more useful way of thinking of that.
Yeah, I think so.
All right. Brad is a high school English teacher. And this is a great question for a writer. I wish I'd thought of this. My wife is a high school English teacher. What would you, if you, what would you recommend him to teach to his high school students? What do you think would be useful for high school kids to read that, you know, might not necessarily be in the regular curriculum?
Oh, that's a great question. And thanks to Brad and your wife for their work. You know, like without, you know, I didn't consider myself a writer even in high school, but without the guidance of Sheila Dixon, who I still talk to from time to time to this day, I think that my ability and belief in myself as someone who could understand and comprehend and think about language would be different. So that's really good work. I am bad at this because I'm always like, you know, I don't know, like kids should, high school students should read The Revolutionary Letters by Baron de Prima. And I think that schools would not want high school kids to read The Revolutionary Letters by Baron de Prima. And so, but, you know, I think high school students should read Beloved by Toni Morrison or Jazz by Toni Morrison. I think high school students should return to Virginia Hamilton and read The People Could Fly. They should read folklore and folk tales. You know, if we're thinking contemporary works, then, you know, Luster by Raven Lelani is a book I love, a fiction book I love so much that I wish I, when I read, you know, fiction now, you know, I think about books that I wish I would have had access to when I was in high school, books that just weren't out yet, or poetry books that weren't out yet, you know? Yeah. They should read Harmony Holiday, the poet Harmony Holiday, all of her work, Jazz Funeral for Uncle Tom specifically. These are, this is why I'm bad at this, because I feel like if I actually put these things in front of high school students.
You just did 2 years of curriculum too, yeah.
Hella books.
I feel like the high schools themselves would be like, we literally cannot read that. But, you know, Too Much and Not the Mood by Durga Chu Bose. Like these folks, these books I love, and I'm looking at my desk right now because I have Daphne Brooks's liner notes for The Revolution, and it's this beautiful, but it's very long, but it's this beautiful book of kind of reclaiming and reformatting the way that music criticism is understood and putting it through the lens primarily of Black women, right? And like, I grew up reading a lot of music criticism, very rarely from Black women, unless I had, you know, occasionally like Danielle Smith would be in the source and Dream Hampton and like these folks, but primarily from men. And when I talk about hip hop criticism or R&B criticism or journalism, but when I like went outside of that realm, like in the era I was growing up, so few Black folks, Black people in general, were writing about classic rock or punk or anything. And this book is so great at saying, no, this kind of thinking was always happening, you just weren't seeing it. And I love those, I love reading texts that give me those reminders. Earlier today, I did an interview when I was asked a question when someone was like, well, what makes your work unique? And I'd be like, ain't shit that makes my work unique. Everything I'm doing is trying to copy and reformat a lineage of writers who were actually unique, who came before me, who have done this already. And I'm just trying to say, okay, what scraps are left at the table? What scraps of brilliance are left that I can kind of tweak on my own? But that's a long answer to a short question.
We've got long answers to short questions are always the best answers. We've got two more questions. I think one more from another high school English teacher, Stefan Jones, who says, how would you talk about the essays in They Can't Kill Us with high school students? Have you had the chance to do that? I mean, I know you're someone So how have those conversations, that's I guess maybe even a better question. How have those conversations gone? How have young people reacted to it? And what have those conversations been like for you?
It's been the most generous engagement I've had with the book because these folks are oftentimes smarter than me, or at least more eager and more optimistic than I am, or at least more realistic in some ways. It's been more interesting. You know, the wild thing about They Can't Kill Us that I'm very grateful for is the book has had a long life. You know, the book is at this point coming up on 4 years old, or is it five? It's four. And I don't feel the same way. I mean, like the work we create, much like I talk about Wipe Me Down, the work we create lives unchanged and we change. And so I don't feel the same way as I did when I wrote some of that stuff. You know, the Chance the Rapper thing, I would have written way differently today. The Obama Rapper's White House thing would have not even made the book, you know, like not because I think that work is bad, but I just, you know, I don't feel the same way I did as I wrote that. And so the talks with high schoolers feel the most gentle and critique heavy, because it's like, I don't see the world. They are, you know, they're so quick to be like, well, I don't see the world this way. And I gotta be like, well, I don't either anymore. Tell me how you see it. You know, like, I'm interested in how you see it. I need to know, like, I need to know what you see. You are, with any luck, if we're talking about a natural arc of living unsevered by tragedy, with any luck, you have a future that will outpace my future. And so therefore, I'm interested. I need to know what makes you look at the world the way you do. And how can I get a little bit of that, maybe, so that I am thinking, so that I don't become so nihilistic, perhaps, and think that I am building a life and living a life that will only carry me until I'm done with it, and not lay a groundwork for a future that I won't be around for. And so I've loved talking to high school students the most, because they have the most interesting things to say about not only the work as I wrote it, but the work as it projects into the future, which it seems like this book has had a long and unexpected future.
Last question from Alato Miwa Oyewole. And I know writers get this question a lot, but there's also a lot of young writers who need to ask the question. So what is your advice for young writers? You said when you were in high school, you didn't necessarily know you were a writer, but at the moment you realized you were, you know, what is advice that you wish that that you had received?
You know, I wish someone would have told me that my impulses aren't ridiculous. And I wish someone would have told me that mimicry is actually an effective tool towards the finding of one's voice. And one thing that I will always say is, keep a notebook of writers that you love, and who have like unlocked something for you, so that if you ever have the opportunity, you can really express that to them. I'm really big now. I feel like I always have been, but I'm bigger now than ever on the expression of real-time gratitude, because we've just lost so many folks. You know what I'm saying? And it isn't a given that we're able to tell people, thank you for your work in real time. And gosh, I remember last year, or whenever our last poetry book came out, Fortune for Disaster came out the same day as the poet Mary Ruffel's book called Dunce. And I love Mary Ruffel's book. I love her writing. I love it so much. And Dunce came out, and I remember, you know, my book had come out that same day, and I, you know, was supposed to be doing all this stuff, but I just read Dunce like 5 times that day. And I remember being like, there's no other option but for me to find a way to contact Mary Ruffel and tell her how much this book means to me today. Because I might not be able to do that again, you know? It's the same when I read an essay online now, or when I read a book by a writer, this kind of stuff. I mean, I really want to tell people, like, this meant a lot to me. And I really, the best advice I can give to young writers is maybe don't stray too far from gratitude. You're going to need it. Like, it's a requirement at this point, I think. Gratitude for your surroundings, and gratitude for, this is why when people say I'm too cynical, I think they're maybe misreading me, because I think I'm propelled by gratitude more than anything. If being cynical means that I am aware of the fact that I may not be alive tomorrow, because I'm acutely aware of the fact that I could perish at any moment, and therefore I have to have a really up against the glass engagement with the type of gratitude that propels me to something better, then I'll take that brand of cynicism. But young writers, I think, need to understand that I'm not the writer I am today without a great many people. You know, like, the first time I met Jackie Woodson, the great Jackie Woodson, I was like, listen, I know you've done a lot of shit and have heard this a lot of times, but I'm not the writer I am without your work. And so, you know, was that like some awards thing? We were both up for an award or some shit. And I got to be like, the only reason I am here up for this little bullshit award or whatever, not bullshit award. But like, you know, I don't really care about that.
Yeah, I feel you, though. Yeah.
But like the only reason I'm here and like up for this like decoration is because your books led me to it. You know what I mean? And so that's my advice for young writers is hold on to gratitude and keep it close because the writers you love are going to hopefully maybe intersect with your writing one day and you got to share it with them while they're still here.
I swear to God, you feel different. Man, dog. Bruh. The way you feel, bro. Right. The way you feel. Whoo. Shit. That's a blessing, dog. Woo.
Yeah, thank you for raising the IQ of the Jenkins and Jones podcast.
I am really
the dumbest shit. We talk about the dumbest shit on here, bro.
I was hoping to talk about some dumb shit. I mean, I'm glad I could talk about the book, but I'm always up for talking about dumb shit.
Gummy bears, candy or fruit snack?
Well, the bears themselves are the candy, right? But I think because fruit snacks have to have some kind of like healthy shit that is not, it's a lie. It's all a lie. Like all fruit snacks are candy.
Scooby-Doo fruit snacks don't have healthy shit in there.
And they're the best fruit snacks on the planet.
Albany's fruit snacks
they
have real
like
fruit
any
juice.
Kind of fruit juice type thing.
I mean, I buy them for my kids and I don't see
Albany's
any,
do.
You know,
Albany's
they don't
fruit
even
snack. Albany's
pretending
gummy
on
bears.
What happened to the, wasn't coming up, wasn't there some shit? So I was raised Muslim, so I can't fuck with gelatin or I didn't fuck with gelatin and all that. So I don't really know the fruit snack, the lineage of fruit snacks that exists in the world. But I feel like when we were young, there was some shit that had like juice in it, like a fruit snack that had
Gushers,
real fruit
Gushers.
Juice in it.
Was that it?
Gushers did not have
real
fruit juice,
but
in
it was juice.
That shit was.
It was juice, bro.
It was
just Kool-Aid. Corn syrup.
I mean, don't get me wrong. I don't think they were like squeezing real orange juice into the center of a Gushers.
That shit was like lean for 8-year olds, bro. That shit was not juice. that was some guy.
Can I say? So my friend Akbar, who's Muslim in high school, almost turned me into a vegetarian when he explained to me why he could not eat gelatin because I didn't know what it was.
Oh yeah.
And he was like, "Well, I can't eat pork." And I said, "Well, it's fucking Starburst. What do you mean you can't eat pork?" And he was like, "You know what gelatin is?" And I was like,
"No."
We probably
had a real ass conversation.
And I was like, "You know, we look it up." I was like, "Ooh."
Yeah, man. People be like, "Yo, why can't you eat Skittles?"
Right.
And I'd be like, "Listen, are you ready for a real ass conversation?"
Like that's some strawberry flavored pig feet you eating right there, bro. Like, you know, that's just delicious,
be hitting, though. That's some delicious pig feet. Shit.
And trust me, I had Skittles once, and I've been craving ever since. You know what I mean? So
Skittles are a treasure. I'll be the first to tell you, as someone who regularly partakes in them. But that goddamn blue tropical bag, oh my god!
That purple bag to me, it's the purple bag for me. That
oh,
shit
the wild
crazy,
berry, yeah.
That
yeah.
shit go dummy, dog.
I got a question.
You said you're interested.
Go ahead. Is it stupid?
You said you're interested in sneakers. I'm wondering, like, you know what I'm saying? Yeah. Like, what pair of sneakers is your grail sneaker? Some people like list some really expensive ass pair that they bought. I think for me, it's usually the one, like, it's a pair that I just couldn't get and I loved as a kid and I got them, you know what I'm saying, as an adult.
So I can do the, I mean, I won't. I can do the like expensive grail, but like lately, I recently got a pair of original. Like the black and red Jordan 1s from 1985 that were unworn. Okay. And that was wild to me because, so I have a couple pairs in my collection that are like as old as I am or older than me. I recently got a pair of Nike Tailwinds from 1980 that were unworn, never been laced. They came with like the receipt. They came with the receipt, the original receipt from 1980.
People sleep on Tailwinds. Tailwinds had a crazy run in the 90s. You know what I'm saying? Like, it wasn't just Air Max.
People sleep
Tailwinds
on
Tailwinds were crazy, yeah.
And so, I found this pair of 85 Jordan, black and red Jordan 1s that I probably have to get the soles refurbished before I wear them out because I think they haven't been worn. They haven't been worn since, you know, 1985. Mm-hmm. And so I imagine, like, once I touch road and the motherfuckers, they falling apart. You know? So I gotta like take those in and get the soles refurbished. But it's that kind of shit. I recently got a pair of 2000, the original Space Jams from 2000. And that's kind of what I'm on now. You know, I have a lot of the stuff that, you know, the exclusive type shit or whatever. But what I'm on now is kind of chasing after the stuff from the 2000s that I couldn't get in high school or going way back to the 80s and getting like original shit. But a pair that I love that that dropped when I was in high school that I feel like was kind of hot then and went away was the white and chrome Jordan 4, mm-hmm. like pure money yeah. ones. And I feel like those, no one gave a fuck about those. I got a pair of those original from 2001 for like $250, which is not usually the case at for all. Shoes from that era that are in mint yeah. condition. And I was like, damn, people really don't care about this pair. But I love that pair. I thought that pair was so cool. It's not as aesthetically pleasing as I remember. I will say that. When I got it in the mail and I opened the box, I was so excited. I was like, yeah, I got this pair I've been chasing. I opened the box and I was like, huh. it's kind of like when you like, you know, when you like go to a new barber and you think shit's going well, you know what I mean? And you're like, oh, this motherfucker's like cutting, you know? And then he hands you the mirror and you're like, oh. Where it's like, it's not bad. It's not like unsightly bad, but it's
shit
like,
ain't sweet.
Yeah, you know, it's like, I think maybe I'm going to go to another barber next time.
Right.
Well, you had a stupid question. You had another stupid question.
Yeah, we actually have a series of stupid arguments that we've had on the podcast. I don't think the plan was not to ask you to weigh in on these, but what is more athletic, a rat or a squirrel?
Well, rats can't climb trees. Can they climb yes. trees?
Yeah, rats can climb.
Oh shit!
Rats can climb fucking anything. That's why they're everywhere. They wouldn't survive in New York if they couldn't climb.
We talking a regular squirrel or a flying
we're
squirrel?
We talking like. If you had to pick somebody on your team on your squad, who would you pick, a rat or a squirrel?
I feel like squirrels can change direction better.
The shiftiness.
I think that rats probably have better like straight line speed, mm-hmm. but I think a squirrel can like has lateral quickness.
I can't believe we subjected this man to this, but anyway, I feel like squirrels are scary. I've seen a squirrel die in the middle of the street because. It didn't know. Me and my buddy were driving down the street. It didn't know which way to go, and it just passed out. I imagine it was a heart attack, maybe an anxiety attack. That doesn't work well when you're trying to, you know.
Squirrels have heart attacks like fucking nothing.
Right.
They'll have a heart attack if you sneeze next to them.
So I'm like,
yeah, but the change of direction is so. It's like I've seen a squirrel do some like Barry Sanders type, yeah. you know. It's depending on the sport. If we're talking about football, I'm taking a squirrel as my running back. Because of the change of direction. But I do imagine a rat has better straight lines.
It'll
speed.
Get hit by, you know what I'm saying? Imagine getting hit by Ray Lewis, a squirrel. That motherfucker dead, dog. We might as well bury that motherfucker on the field. You feel me? That's how I feel. So what do you think is more important, a peanut butter and jelly sandwich? Peanut butter or jelly?
Oh, wait a minute. Wait. Mm. I had an obvious answer, but, well, here's my thing. It's almost required, my like high level philosophical answer is that it's almost required to be jelly because there are more types of jelly than there are okay. peanut butter. Like you can, if you're including like everything on the jelly jam spectrum, the possibilities are kind of like not endless, but more plentiful than they are with peanut butter, unless you're including alternative nut butters and whatnot. But even then, no, because you said peanut butter. Okay, so let's stick to just peanut butter. You got crunchy, you got smooth. Jelly, you got grape, strawberry, preserves, jams, apricot shit. I think jelly can really turn the tide for a sandwich. But I actually think the real answer is the bread.
Okay. Okay. I'm over two tonight.
There's a place in Columbus that serves like a fried peanut butter and jelly sandwich that I haven't tried because I, you know, like I'm older and I feel like.
Is that to set you back a whole week?
Yeah, you know what I was gonna say, like, there's certain stuff I can like certainly still eat, but like in the eating of it, it's like, all right, well, I gotta like plan around. You know, I don't want to make a plan around eating a fried peanut butter and jelly sandwich. I'm not ready to give in to that admission of age just yet. But nonetheless, I had like a large cake the other day, and I was like, I'm down for the count. I'm gonna be sleeping for like. I got to schedule naps into the next 3 days.
And it will take you 3 weeks to get those calories off you.
You know what I mean? Like, I just can't do it. So, but peanut butter and jelly, I haven't had a peanut butter and jelly in a while, though I sometimes think about it because, you know, it's easy to make and it's a great meal. But it's also wild to me that when I was a kid, we would go to school with just lunch boxes that were like mostly sugar.
Right.
You know, it was like mm-hmm. peanut butter and jelly. Chocolate milk,
Gushers,
whatever else. Yeah, you're the gushers.
No, like, I think we were the worst fed generation ever because, like, you know, our parents were working more, like, you know what I'm saying, and all that, and so convenient.
Our parents were just eating animal fat for breakfast, bro. I mean, it wasn't even
I'm
any.
I'm saying, our parents, like, they had actual food. We were canned goods, all that shit was popping when we were, you know what I'm saying? Like, I mean, my mom was having real meals, like, you know what I'm saying? Like, for us, it was like convenience was more important. So my they weren't eating box fucking tuna helper. My mom wasn't. But I sure was, you feel me? Like, and Glory Greens.
Best believe.
You bring Glory Greens to the crib. I mean, you know, and before our generation, you might not be able to come back to the house for years, nigga. You know what I'm saying? You know, for us, you feel me? Like, they just throwing them shits on. It was normal for us, man. Like, but anyway, so I feel like our generation was horrible. Like, all the sugar, all that shit. Coming home, eating trash, too. Luckily,
it's a fight, bro.
Shit now, though,
Hanif, I have a third grader and a kindergartner, and I do the I do breakfast and I make their lunch and I drop them off at school in the morning. And it's I give them some apples and carrots, but it takes twice as long as throwing the fucking Oreo dipper in the bag. You know what I mean?
Oh, like, definitely throw the Oreo dipper in the bag. Yeah,
man. It's about we're trying to have some balance, but it's tough, bro. Because the sugar shit, you just pull it out of the box and drop it in the lunchbox, and you're done.
And now your kids addicted to sugar for the rest of their life. You know what I'm saying? Nah, man. But anyway,
Hanif, thank you so much for joining us. You mentioned it a couple times, but Little Devil in America is your most recent book. People should for sure check out. And you have coming out Saturday an audio documentary on The Score that's coming out on Pineapple Street that I know the three of us are very excited about. And thanks, man. This is kind of new for us to do like a book club and actually have someone on. But I know a lot of our listeners were excited about it as a change of pace from off-season fucking NBA talk.
Yeah, listen, I love off-season NBA talk personally, but it's been a dry. I mean, it's been exciting for the Timberwolves, but it's all, you know, it's all speculation for something that will never come true for us. So this is much more exciting than me refreshing Ben Simmons news every 2 hours.
You're much more exciting than us talking about fucking Rondo joining the fucking Lakers and shit too. Thank God you came on, bro. I was captivated, man. I've been fucking whining. I hate this basketball talk. Thank God for relieving me from that shit, man. Jeez.
Nah, I appreciate y'all truly. To have the book be a book club pick and to have it resonate with y'all's community means a whole lot to me. And it's a real pleasure to get to chop it up with y'all.
Sure. Likewise, we appreciate you, bro.
All right. Our thanks to Hanif for joining us. What a great interview. When basketball season comes back, we might need to spin off the book club podcast. I'm having a fucking blast.
I think we need to continue this, bro. Like, I mean, like I said, I can't believe I was excited about his brain coming on our pod. Like, we really are getting this motherfucker brain to talk to us. Like, you know what I mean? Like, I thought that was beautiful. He's so brilliant. And the most in-depth answers for, you know, like, seemingly simple questions. He sees so deep and he feels so different. It was truly a pleasure. And I'm being silly, but that's how I fucking feel, my nigga. You feel me?
Yeah, definitely a writer's mind, you know, deep emotions and can express them fluidly. Like, I was just amazed by the answers he was giving. Shouts to Hanif.
I felt bad when he was like, he wanted to come hang out. You know what I mean? Right. We're asking him all these real questions. He was like, man, I thought I was going to come chill.
We'll get him on for some basketball talking sometime because he know a whole bunch about that shit. But yeah, I just want to know, like, what went behind this book. I just, you know, I'm glad that he nerded out with us. You know what I'm saying?
For sure.
For sure. Okay, so like I said earlier, make sure you get How the Word Is Passed. Check out the first couple chapters of that through the end of the Angola Prison chapter. And we'll be talking about that on next Thursday's podcast. We're hoping to get Clint Smith on as well when we're done reading that book. So, you know, if you're reading and you think of questions, I thought we got some great questions for Hanif. That was not something any of us anticipated we'd be doing with this fucking podcast, but that was cool. So, yes, I think that's it, right? Anything else?
Nah, man. Peace.
Bye.
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 This is Malcolm Gladwell from Revisionist History. eBay Motors is here for the ride. With some elbow grease, fresh installs, and a whole lot of love, you transformed 100,000 miles and a body full of rust into a drive that's all your own. Brake kits, LED headlights, whatever you need, eBay Motors has it. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, it's guaranteed to fit your ride the first time, every time, or your money back. Plus, at these prices, you're burning rubber, not cash. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply.
Got menopause? We've got you. Hi, Jackie here, founder of ExoJackie. Feel supported throughout your menopause journey and beyond with our organic protein powders and symptom relief boosts. Formulated to keep bones and muscles strong, ExoJackie products help reduce bloating, hot flashes, and weight gain. Enjoy 20% off with promo code EXOPODCAST. Shop now at ExoJackie.com. Made for women by women.
This episode brought to you by 20th Century Studios' Kingdom of the Planet of the Apes. Director Wes Ball breathes new life into the epic franchise. As a ruthless king attempts to build his empire at the expense of the remaining human race, a young ape begins a journey to fight for a future for apes and humans alike. Kingdom of the Planet of the Apes. Enter the kingdom in IMAX on May 10th and theaters everywhere. Get tickets now.
With the new Dexcom G7, you can achieve better diabetes results without painful fingersticks. It sends your glucose numbers to your compatible phone or watch so you can always see where you are and where you're heading. See how food and exercise affects your glucose, making it easier to spend more time in range and lower your A1C. Take more control of your diabetes with the number one recommended CGM brand. It's easy to get started today at Dexcom.com. That's Dexcom.com.
Dexcom data on file 2023. If your glucose alerts and readings from the G7 do not match symptoms or expectations, use a blood glucose meter to make diabetes treatment decisions. For a list of compatible devices, visit Dexcom.com/compatibility.